all the sins.
Exactly. Imam Ali al-Islam said, As-salatu ala al-Nabi amhaqu lil-khataya min al-ma' lil-nar. Imam mentions kind of comparison or kind of simile. He says that you see how the water extinguishes the fire, then salawat extinguishes and moves and removes the sins even more than that.
Wonderful.
This is in Thawab al-A'mal by Sheikh Sadur, page 185. The other point mentioned in the narration is that when you recite salawat, then the gates of heaven get open, kind of metaphor referring to the fact that you will receive the mercy of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And another positive point, which might be worldly point for salawat, is that it will remove bad people from around you. This is the best action to be done on Friday, and this is mentioned in a couple of narrations
so
as well.
So it will protect you.
Yeah, one of the most recommended actions to be done on Fridays is to recite salawat. Another point mentioned in the narrations is to say salawat collectively as a group of people, and that is why we see it as a kind of tradition among the Muslims, especially the Shia. When they are in mosque or, religious places,
they
send salawat
together
collectively. It's been mentioned that if people do that, then the reward is so much that it cannot be counted even by the angels. It's a kind of metaphor referring to the greatness of that reward. Some narrations talk about the fact that you shouldn't take salawat lightly. For example, a person who, after hearing the name of the Prophet, does not send him salawat, does not recite salawat, he is called a kind of a stingy person, and as a kind of person who would be regretful on the hereafter. There are some occasions for which sending salawat is more important, is more recommended. For example, whenever you mention the name of God and you remember God, it's been mentioned that it's recommended for you to recite salawat as well. After each and every prayer, one of the recommended actions is to recite salawat, one of the ta'qibat. According to some narrations, after any speech, recite salawat. After, as I mentioned before, and after any kind of prayer, when you mention the name of other prophets, this is also interesting. According to some narrations, when you read the name of other prophets, send divine blessing upon that prophet, but also send blessing upon the name of our prophet and his progeny as well. And before sending salam to that prophet, send salam and salawat to the prophet. And that is why, for example, you see that the scholars, they say, for example, Prophet Musa, ala nabiyyina wa alihi wa alayhi salam. Prophet Musa, divine blessings be upon our prophet and his progeny and him. This is based on the narration. So when we hear the name of the prophets, we are also recommended to send salawat upon our prophet and his progeny as well. And last but not least, according to some narrations, if you forget something, one of the ways to remember that is to send salawat. So these are some of the positive points and rewards for reciting salawat. Again, I repeat the fact that it doesn't mean that in all the cases we will receive automatically these rewards. Many of them are based
everything on, is dependent on the purity of your
exactly.
heart.
Exactly. And sometimes we do a good action, but then we spoil it by a bad action. So sins are acting as a kind of barrier for receiving these good and positive points as well. So we shouldn't spoil the good actions by committing the sins too.
So since we were talking about reciting salawat, we are going to finish this episode by reciting salawat on our Prophet. So thank you, dear listeners, and Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil farajahu.
Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. Li Aliyin wa Husayn wa Hasan. Li Aliyin wa Husayn وحسن لبان إن في الجنة نهرا من لبان إن في الجنة نهرا من لبان لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن
The beginning of the end. Part 1.
When Saudi Arabia's Aramco oil facilities were targeted in drone attacks, Riyadh could hardly imagine that the consequences of the face-off with Yemen would be so harsh. Saudi Arabia is Yemen's largest neighbor and the largest country in the Arabian Peninsula. Most of the country is comprised of vast deserts, Saudi Arabia owes its significance among Arab and Islamic countries to two holy and religious cities of Mecca and Medina. Islam is the birthplace of Saudi Arabia and was exported to other countries. After the discovery of oil, Saudi Arabia gradually became one of the, or I better say, the biggest oil exporter in the world. Saudi Arabia's significance today is a combination of the historical significance and its economic weight. Saudi Arabia has always been pivotal in the developments in Yemen, but the relationship between Saudi Arabia and Yemen has many complications. When supporters of Gamal Abdel Nasser and Arab nationalists rose up against the ruling of the Zaydis, Saudi Arabia sided with the Zaydis because if Nasser had come to power, it would pose a danger to Arab monarchies. Nasser became Egypt's president after toppling a monarchical rule. He was against Arab and even Iranian monarchs. He had strong socialist tendencies, and at the same time, he would call himself an Arab nationalist. He would fight with Israel and the UK on the one hand, and on the other, he used a different name for the Persian Gulf and claimed that the three Iranian islands belonged to Arabs. After the 9/11 attacks, Ali Abdullah Saleh, who had previously toppled the Zaydi rule, got closer to the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. Riyadh secretly funded al-Qaeda and got closer to Saleh, so Saleh released many al-Qaeda terrorists in return. But the friendly ties faced a major problem. The problem was initiated somewhere far away. A poor man in Tunisia set himself ablaze in front of a government building. It was the beginning of a revolution that spread to many Arab countries. It was the beginning of a new story for Yemen. The wave of Islamism in the world was set off in 1979 after the victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution. Before that, anti-West activists in the region were either nationalists or socialists and leftists. But after the revolution, inclinations towards Islamic teachings turned into the major inclination in the anti-Western activism among the people of the region. In 1986, a political group named the Houthi Union was formed in this part of Yemen. Scholars like Mohammed Badreddin al-Houthi and Majid Eddin al-Muyayidi taught subjects about Iran's revolution to the group. Yemeni's interests in the revolution stem from their passion for Islamic teachings. Traditionally, there were people who had lived with those teachings generation after generation, and they naturally welcomed the teachings in the political and social arena. The Association of Faithful Youth was established in 1992. Badreddin al-Houthi had a role in founding the association along with Muhammad Saleh Azam and Abdul Karim Jaban. In 1997, the organization of the Faithful Youth splintered off the previous association under the leadership of Hussein Badreddin al-Houthi. Hussein's goal was to return to the ruling by the imams and abstention from giving zakat, that's religious taxes, to the illegal government. In other words, they wanted to establish an Islamic government. In fact, the Islamic Revolution and the establishment of an Islamic government in Iran served as a role model. In Yemen, just like in Lebanon, Bahrain, Palestine, and Afghanistan, some people came up with the idea of establishing an Islamic government. Hussein Badreddin al-Houthi moved towards military training. After the military training in the Organization of the Faithful Youth was raised, more youth welcomed it warmly. Ali Abdullah Saleh's government had a dual approach vis-a-vis the organization. At first, it tolerated the organization and even financially supported the organization's schools and its cultural activities because by the help of the organization, it could stop Al-Qaeda and Wahhabi infiltration in Yemen. Wahhabis took advantage of the abject poverty in Yemen and propagated themselves to find supporters. Saudi Arabia also funded them. Ali Abdullah Saleh was worried the changes may threaten his own government as well. But when he found out about their political tendencies and military training, things changed. He closed down the organization's schools and put their leaders under surveillance. But Sayyid Hussein Houthi's father, Sayyid Bedreddin, who was one of the revered religious marjayas in Yemen, intervened to reopen the schools. The government set a condition that Sayyid Hussein has no right to get involved with the schools. Hussein moved to Sada'a. Sada'a is a city near the Saudi border in a mountainous region. It's an old city with typical Yemeni buildings, but now it's the capital of Sada'a province. Houthis are from this province. Hussein al-Houthi moved from Sada'a to a small province named Haydan, 39 kilometers away from the provincial capital Sada'a. Hussein al-Houthi became the prayers leader of the Grand Mosque in the Haydan and started his activities to recruit forces. In the Zaydi sect, only a person who rises up with a sword can become a leader, just like Zayd, Imam Zayn al-Abidin's son, the Zaydis follow. So Hussein proclaimed his leadership. The main motto of his movement was to fight the U.S. Politically, Hussein was a supporter of the Islamic Republic of Iran. What's more, he supported anti-Israeli Islamic groups like Hezbollah and the Palestinian Islamic Resistance Movement. Sayyid Hussein considered Israel as one of the main enemies of Islam. He launched a campaign to ban Israeli and U.S. goods in Yemen. The administration of Ali Abdullah Saleh sensed the danger. An Islamic movement in Yemen, similar to Hezbollah, could be a threat to his long-time rule. Many Houthi youths were arrested on charges of trying to restore the Zaydi government. That was a time when the U.S. faced the 9/11 attacks. أحداث الحادي عشر من أيلول سبتمبر. If Wahhabism was considered a problem for Muslims and the Islamic world, now, after the September 11th attacks, everyone in the world was saying that Wahhabism is a major problem. U.S. asked many countries to arrest certain individuals known as Wahhabi leaders who were tied to terrorist activities. In Yemen, several names were mentioned who were top political figures. Yemeni tribes would not turn them in. Ali Saleh knew Yemen's tribal structure and decided not to get into a conflict with the structure. So he negotiated with the U.S. ambassador in Yemen and convinced him that the Houthi movement was more dangerous than Al-Qaeda. Ali Saleh's main argument was that the Houthi movement followed Imam Khomeini's thoughts, and it means the Houthis consider the U.S. as their main enemy. finally, on the sidelines of a G8 summit in 2004, Ali Abdullah Saleh managed to get Washington's approval to crack down on the Houthis. The crackdown started in Sada'a. In September of 2004, Hussein al-Houthi was killed in a Maran district, but his death did not put an end to the war. When the war broke out between followers of the Houthis and the government forces, there were only 200 Houthi fighters. But after Hussein al-Houthi's death, his brother Abdulmalik al-Houthi recruited several hundred thousand people for the organization. Abdulmalik was Hussein's younger brother. He was born in 1979. His ideas were not different from his brother's, fighting with oppressive rulers and providing welfare and education for the poor. After Hussein al-Houthi's death and Abdulmalik's succession, Hussein's father, Badreddin al-Houthi, went to Sana'a for talks with Ali Abdullah Saleh, but he returned empty-handed. The war started again. In the spring of 2005, the second war ended after the victory of the government. In the fall of the same year, the conflict started once again and continued until the spring of the following year. In 2006, while there was a truce agreement between the Houthis and the Houthis demanded that 7 Yemeni Jews be expelled. They said the 7 Jews spread corruption among the youth. In reaction to the request, Ali Abdullah Saleh wrote a letter to Abdulmalik and asked him to hand over their arms and forces. Soon, the fourth war broke out, and in the spring of 2007, the fifth war. The fifth war started after several people close to the government were assassinated, and the government accused the Houthis of those killings. A claim refused by the Houthis, but the war was inevitable. This time around, the war spilled over to other provinces as well. Ali Abdullah realized that the odds were against him. During the 30th anniversary of his presidency on July 17, 2008, he announced that the fifth war was over and promised that no new war will be launched between the government and the Houthis. But his promise did not last long. The following year, on July 10, 2009, Ali Saleh claimed that the Houthis had violated the truce and attacked government-controlled areas. The Saleh government launched a Saudi-backed airstrike on the Houthis. Saleh talked to the heads of the tribes and warned them that the Houthis want to restore the Zaydi movement under the leadership of Abdulmalik. This time, the Houthis were successful. They had Katyushas, and cannons, and managed to achieve numerous victories. The U.S. and Saudi fighter jets directly entered the war. But the Houthis took shelter in the mountainous areas that were not accessible by the fighter jets. These mountains have served as a hideout for Yemeni fighters against offensive tribes for centuries. Now, the mountains became the shelters for the Yemenis once again. In February 2010, the tribal chiefs intervened to stop the war. Next year, in 2011, Sadr and the Houthis were no longer the biggest threats to Ali Abdullah Saleh. Ali Saleh was the president of Yemen for decades. He was planning on having his son succeed him. Corruption was widespread across the country and people were poor. It wasn't anything new, but when people got the news that the revolutions were taking place in Tunisia and Egypt, Yemenis also took to the streets. This time, Sana'a turned into the resistance bastion against the government.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Opposition to expansion of NATO, which harbors some wishes of establishing a presence in the Central Asia region, and also the imminent danger of Daesh's revival in Afghanistan, something which would threaten Iran and Russia's borders, are among the areas of commonality between Moscow and Tehran these days that can pave the way for new areas of cooperation. We now present you an article written by Ali Reza Hojati, a journalist and an international relations commentator. The piece is titled Farewell to the United States, Welcome to New World Order. Tripartite meeting of the heads of the three guarantor states of the Astana peace process, namely the Islamic Republic of Iran, Russia and Turkey, in Tehran, is strongly indicative of the political weight of regional and trans-regional actors in connection with the new security architecture of West Asia. As it took place only a few days after US President Joe Biden's first visit to the region, Israeli newspaper Haaretz even wrote in an analysis published on 14th of July that Iran's supreme leader will determine if Biden's West Asia trip succeeds. Although Biden told leaders of six countries of the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council, PGCC, that is Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Bahrain, Kuwait, Oman and the United Arab Emirates, plus Jordan, Egypt and Iraq, at a summit in Saudi Arabia's Red Sea city of Jeddah, on Saturday, 16th of July, that the United States will not walk away from West Asia and leave a vacuum to be filled by Russia, China or Iran. There is almost no one in the region to accept such rhetoric as true. The Arab states of the Persian Gulf region and West Asia actors are closely monitoring unfolding developments in Afghanistan and in Ukraine, in addition to America's behavior towards them. This explains why regional actors have set realism high on their agenda, and Arab states don't really want to put all their eggs in the basket of weakened Washington, and are instead following the policy of détente and cooperation with Iran, at the same time as maintaining good relations with both Russia and China. It is obvious that Tehran and its partners have attained significant achievements against Washington out of the seventh summit of the Astana peace talks on Syria, which hosted Vladimir Putin of Russia and Recep Tayyip Erdogan of Turkey. Syria is a clear example of victory of this alliance over the United States and its Western allies. And the Russo-Iranian-Syrian initiative now determines the path that the Damascus government should tread. The Syrian conflict is among the most successful models of cooperation between Iran and Russia in terms of foreign policy. The grave crisis in Syria created a perception among Russian officials that Moscow should attach greater significance to Tehran's standpoints as regards its calculations in West Asia. Iran's foreign minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian wrote in his book, The Levant Morning, that he and the former Deputy Foreign Minister for Arab and African Affairs started negotiations with Russian authorities on the latter's involvement in Syria. Amir Abdullahian went on to cite then-Russian ambassador to Iran as saying that talks on Syria acted as a catalyst for the promotion of bilateral diplomatic relations between Moscow and Tehran and opened a new chapter for mutual cooperation. The top Iranian diplomat further alluded to comments made by a Russian security official that Moscow finally concluded that Iranians have strongly supported their allies in the region for years, have not changed their approach even in the face of major US campaigns and threats, and that it is Iran and its allies that have played an important role in regional developments and obtained acceptable results eventually. The Russian official remarked, "By examining Iran's behavior in Afghanistan, Iraq, Lebanon, and Palestine, we came to the conclusion that Bashar al-Assad will remain in office, and Tehran gets its own way in the end." The Astana Process's main agenda lies in provision of support for and protection of Syria's territorial integrity, fighting terrorism, and provision of support for establishment of a ceasefire. Over the past weeks, the most important speculation and news items in this regard have been the prospect of a Turkish operation against Kurds in northern Syria. Some speculation concerning reduction of the Russian military presence in Syria and simultaneous increase in the resistance axis's weight there, and the Israeli regime's intense concerns about this, and unprecedented tension in Moscow-Tel Aviv relations. However, it can be expected that Vladimir Putin would hold important meetings with senior Iranian officials, especially given the fact that the aspects of the country's military cooperation has prompted concern and ire in the White House. Iran and Russia share a common perspective concerning the sanctions that the United States has leveled against both countries, Iran's nuclear agreement, revisionism in the current order, and international unilateralism. This common perspective paves the way for the country's cooperation. These areas of commonality are of such importance in the Kremlin foreign policy apparatus assessments that have seen Vladimir Putin meet with Iranian President Dr. Ebrahim Raisi on three occasions in Moscow, in Ashgabat and in Tehran over the past 6 months. Moscow's approval of Iran's membership in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, SCO, and its negative vote against the anti-Iranian resolution at the International Atomic Energy Agency's Board of Governors can be interpreted and analysed in the same light. Moscow has even assessed Iran as a country that is competent enough to join the BRICS group. Opposition to the expansion of NATO, which harbours some wishes of establishing a presence in the Central Asia region, and also the imminent danger of Daesh's revival in Afghanistan, something which would threaten both Iran and Russia's borders, are among other areas of commonality between Tehran and Moscow these days that can pave the way for new areas of cooperation. Over the past month, the heads of the Central Asian countries, including the heads of state in Tajikistan, Kazakhstan and Turkmenistan, have travelled to Iran and inked many bilateral agreements, to the point that Iran has even inaugurated its UAV manufacturing factory in Tajikistan. These are all indications that prove Russia considers Iran to be of a special role and is eyeing to entrench and reinforce Iran's foothold in the region in order to eliminate the aforementioned threats as part of the Central Asia and South Caucasus dossier, which international relations theoreticians lay emphasis on in the discussions that concern transition in the world order from the Atlantic to the Pacific.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to your own program, Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we try to discuss problems, questions, and issues parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and narrations from Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. Today in the studio, we have with us our guest speaker, Brother Sheikh Miqdad,
who is a researcher in the Hausa Ilmi Afkam. Assalamu alaikum, brother.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you very much, and salam to all the listeners, inshallah, out there.
Brother, when we talk about Islamic upbringing, there are so many issues we can talk about, but as the world is changing today at a pace that we cannot even imagine, and in this changing world, so many things are changing, and one of those is the age of puberty in boys. You know, the age of puberty in boys is no more 15. We are seeing boys getting, you know, mature at a pretty earlier age. How do we deal with this?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So it's a very important question. And obviously a lot can be said about this discussion on bulugh and the age of puberty, as you mentioned.
I'll
just highlight a few points for this show see what we can, how we can really tackle this issue, and also kind of practical points for parents to be able to deal with it. So first and foremost, when we talk about bulugh from an Islamic perspective, we're talking about the age from which a person is accountable for his deeds or her deeds.
Okay.
So this is where you can say it's known as your book of deeds is now open, whatever you're responsible for, Allah will, the result of it is seen in your actions, the result of it is seen in the Day of Judgment,
okay.
and punishment and reward comes in place, basically.
Okay.
This, for girls, happen at the age of 9, I emphasize that it's on based on a lunar calendar, so it's not 9 based on a normal calendar that we use usually,
okay.
But it's on the lunar calendar, which is around 8 years and a few months, according to the normal calendar. That's for girls. For boys, it happens... it happens at the age of 15, technically, but there are more than just age factors related. So, inshallah, you can refer to the books of Ahkam for what brings about bulugh, or what are the period when bulugh comes in for boys.
Okay.
The point that you mentioned, which is very valid, which is seen, we have seen this over the past few decades, is that the age of bulugh used to be 15, around 14 to 15. Up until a few centuries ago.
Yeah.
But recently we've seen children from the age of 12, 13 becoming baligh, basically. So they've shown those signs, and from that age, they're now baligh. So everything that's wajib for them to do is now wajib to do. They have to refrain from that which is haram.
All right.
Now, this is the Islamic perspective on bulugh. But you have to understand that what happens is that we're also going through a physical maturity as well, as well as an emotional maturity as
well, right?
And you can also add an intellectual maturity as well.
All right. So now we need to talk about what happens when all these changes come in physically, intellectually, and emotionally. We'll talk on that. But for now, you said that bulugh is something when a person is held accountable for his deeds. I'll continue this discussion with you after a break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIV English Radio.
Hey, stop! I got a favorite game!
IRIV English Radio presents a priceless gift to parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this israf to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We are talking about the age of puberty in boys. Brother Miqdad, you said that age of puberty is the age when A person is held accountable for his deeds. As per lunar calendar, it's 9 for girls and 15 for boys. But in the changing world, we are seeing that this 15 has come out to be, it's somewhere around 12, our boys are now mature. So you were about to talk, how do we deal with this?
Yeah. So the problem, where really the problem lies, is that this physical maturity happens earlier nowadays, right? So they become physically mature, showing all the signs of maturity physically earlier than many, many decades ago.
Yeah.
But the emotional maturity as well as the intellectual maturity of these teenagers hasn't matured yet. And so because of this discrepancy and this kind of lack of
coordination between the
emotional state and the physical state, what happens is that you find these teenagers are now become baligh but cannot deal with it from an intellectual and an emotional perspective. Yeah. I mean, just to give you a very, very kind of random example, you would say perhaps, but back in the days, you hear stories about girls from the age of 13 becoming mothers, right? Yeah. So girls, physically, they become mature at the age of 9, and they would become mothers from the age of 13. Now, I'm not saying this is a good thing or a bad thing. The point over here is that they will be emotionally mature enough at the age of 13 to be able to have children.
Yeah.
Right. And you don't find in history issues whereby you would count these 13-year-olds as children, basically.
Yeah.
Nowadays, it's completely unthinkable of a girl at the age of 13 becoming mother.
Yeah.
Right. Again, I'm not saying good or bad. I'm just saying that what's happening is that the emotional growth of teenagers today's world is much slow.
Yeah.
The intellectual growth of teenagers is much slow. So, for example, take the example of hijab. I keep giving examples of girls. I'll come to boys in a second. Today, a lot of parents ask questions about, my girl, she's 19, but she just cannot wear the hijab. Why? Because she doesn't understand what that means.
Okay.
So what has happened, basically, is that this person has reached physical maturity and Islamic maturity, but the emotional and the intellectual maturity hasn't come.
Yeah.
And so this is a big challenge we're facing today. And so what the question you're asking is a very valid question, is that why is it the fact that our children are going through physical maturity very quickly?
Yeah.
In the case of boys, earlier than normal.
And they're lacking behind.
Exactly, in emotional and intellectual stage. And this is why you find these kind of issues where children, boys are like 14, they're 13, 14, they still have no understanding what namaz is, how to have self-control.
Okay.
Oh, these things are lacking. Why? Because they don't have this emotional and intellectual maturity.
We'll continue the discussion with you, Brother Miqdad, after a very short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, he who recites the Quran before puberty has indeed been given wisdom in his childhood.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات.
Welcome back. This is the program Islamic Upbringing. We are talking about the age of puberty in boys. Brother Miqdad, you said that when a boy gets mature at a very early age physically and he's not getting mature intellectually or emotionally, there's this lack of coordination between his physical state, intellectual state, and emotional state. How do parents deal with this?
Okay, so that's the practical aspect, the most important thing we need to talk about. Before I talk about how to deal with it, let's talk about the cause and what led to boys becoming bulugh earlier than expected.
Yes, true.
And based on that, we can then talk about how we can
deal with this. All right. So because even doctors say that in order to cure a disease, we first need to know the cause of the disease.
Yeah.
So if you can help us in understanding the causes, we'll be thankful.
So one of the things, perhaps one of the main things that has happened is the exposure to explicit sexual material from a very young age.
Okay.
Right. So the exposure that boys have to explicit sexual content and material, whether it's in a physical sense or even through the media, through the imagination, etc., This is a primary cause of bulugh and physical maturity happening earlier. Yeah. So if you look at the stats, it's actually very astonishing, mm-hmm. right? The stats out there. And to be honest, it's very profound and very explicit and very wide range in the West. But you would say it's also very prevalent in Africa, in other parts of the world, India, Pakistan as well. Same thing. It's very much out there in the whole world. You find 30%, some of the stats, for example, say that 30% of children have seen extremely explicit material by the age of 11.
Okay. Right?
The level of exposure to pornography, for example, or explicit scenes from earlier 7, 8, 9, right?
Yeah.
This is a cause of boys reaching maturity much earlier.
Yeah.
Another factor that's been mentioned quite often is the home surrounding as well. So, okay, fine, we can work on the outside exposure that we have. But unfortunately, you find that many times a lot of things that happens at home is also very much effective. Okay. So, for instance, one of the causes that has been studied and suggested by researchers is the dress code at home. So mothers not wearing decent clothing at home.
Very decent or proper clothing.
Exactly. It's a factor that's directly influencing bulugh in boys.
Okay.
So this is a very important, and when we talk about practical points as well, we'll talk about this. For example, the dress code at home is extremely important, both for mothers as well as for sisters as well.
Okay.
This is very important. The relationship between a father and a wife, so the mother and the father, for example, at home, what kind of behavior they have between them. In front of the children is very important as well.
Yeah.
Other things that affect, one of them is diet. Junk food and the kind of food that we commonly eat, basically, has been suggested to have influence in this as well.
Okay.
The lack of exercise is another one as well. So obviously, you find teenagers in a sedentary world that we live in right now, sedentary behavior.
Yeah,
it's so prevalent.
Inactive.
Being inactive, lack of exercise, all of this kind of plays a part in maturity becoming earlier.
Yeah.
So these are what happens basically in terms of physical maturity coming earlier. In terms of emotional and intellectual maturity coming later now, because that, you can even say that's been delayed kind of thing, is because of many reasons, right?
Well, we would want to discuss with you all those reasons in our next session.
Sure.
We discussed physical causes today, why there's a physical maturity in boys earlier. And you said there are so many reasons. There's explicit material that is exposed to children as early as the age of 7, especially boys. Decent and proper clothing needs to be taken care of by mothers and sisters. And the relationship of father and mother, the junk foods and lack of exercise and sedentary life. Thank you so much, brother, for being with us.
Jazakallah.
Thank you so much, dear listeners. You are listening to the IRIB English Radio. In case you have any questions, please feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can also find us on social media platforms by just searching Call of Islam Radio. In case you want to listen to this program again, you can just go back to our website, that's www.parstoday.com, and search us under the tab of Call of Islam. Until another session, fi amanillah, and God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.